listening to The Limitless, the podcast between. I'm Jason Horsley, and this week I'm talking to Hunter Muse about her experiences with Carlos Castaneda, Clear Green, and Ten Segrety. I think I hinted or said in the email, I like to focus on details. I know that can extend indefinitely, so we only got a couple of hours today, but we can always continue later if we both want to and we haven't got to everything. Just for now, anyway, I'd really like to know more, because even though I've spoken with you with Chris, and I've listened to several of your interviews with Chris, I don't really know the specific kind of mundane details of your involvement with Castaneda's group. So if we could just start there with a timeline, like how did you hear, because obviously you read the books and all that, but how did you first become involved with the group?
Well, I went to my first seminar in Scottsdale, Arizona. And I wouldn't say that it was a recruiting seminar, but in many ways it felt like they were kind of going through the crowd of people and kind of looking for people that had a lot of energy, people who were committed. And I was so interested in the work that I just jumped right into it. Mm-hmm. So basically every mandate that was suggested, I took it as though I was reading a tablet, like it was a gospel. And so they talked a lot about changing diet and behavior and doing these movements. We did movements at the seminars, and I immediately took to it. It was something that I felt very connected with, because it was something physical. In all of my research before, it had been very philosophical and esoteric and reading, but not really doing a lot of movements with an intention.
Right. Was that advertised publicly then?
It was. It was at a bookstore in Tempe, Arizona, where I found this pamphlet. I had gone in to place an order for another book, and there was a pamphlet on the counter that said Carlos Castaneda's Ten Segrety. And it had a photo or kind of looked like a drawing of these orbs or these cocoon-like eggs that were luminous. And so immediately I knew who Carlos was, but I didn't know what Ten Segrety was. And right. So in the pamphlet, it basically explained that these were teachings that had been passed down through a lineage of 16 generations of sorcerers' parties, and that they were going to start teaching these teachings out in public. They were going to start having these seminars. And so there was about a 6 to 8 week lag from the time that I saw the pamphlet to when the actual seminar was. And fortuitously, it was over a birthday weekend for me. So my best friend and I took her college money, because she received student loan. We took that money and we purchased entrance to the seminar. I think it was $400 for the weekend. And so we went and assumed that Carlos would be there, but he wasn't at that specific seminar. It was Kylie Lundahl, Naim Yurez, Reni Murez, Florinda Donner, and I believe Taisha Abelar spoke at the seminar. So it was his quote-unquote witches party, which are Taisha Abelar and Florinda Donner. They spoke, and then the Chakmuls, who were these three women that were purported to be the holders or the teachers of these movements.
Do you remember the date, roughly?
Oh, it was in the 90s, the early 90s. I could tell you the exact date, maybe 94, I would say, somewhere around there, 93, 94.
This was probably before Magical Passes came out then.
It was before Magical Passes.
Hence, you'd never heard of Tensegrity,
Magical Passes came out when we were in the midst of another seminar at UCLA. There was a week-long seminar, it was an intensive. And that came maybe a year after this first seminar that I went to. But he had been giving talks at the Phoenix Bookstore in Santa Monica, California for probably 10 years prior to that. Just little talks with, reading passages from a book or having these kind of open discussions for years. And I had no idea.
Right, I never heard about that.
Yeah, I mean, as a teenager, I mean, Jason, once I read these books, I was like, where do I find this person? If he's claiming that there is a another attention and another level of awareness that's dreaming, and that you can obtain that by doing these specific things, I want to be a part of that because I know that there's more to the world than this known world. I know that the system that I've been fed and the story I've been fed is not real, that this is a sublimation of a reality, and we just all agree upon it. So when I went into something that was again physical, it was so much easier for me to adopt the quote unquote program because it gave me actual tasks to do. And it wasn't always within a group. The thing that was very dichotomous to me was that he claimed that these were magical passes that had been passed down through all these lineages, and that you shouldn't do them in the group. That in reality, this should be almost like yoga. You shouldn't really practice yoga in a group of people. That's a private, it's like a spiritual endeavor. So I felt like, okay, I want to jump into this, and the mass is important. And to be able to move with the mass, 400 people in a room doing the same movements, there is something that happens there energetically. And so I was attracted to that. But what I was really fascinated by was what happened when I did these things alone, the dreaming that I experienced.
Right. So there were roughly 400 people at that first seminar.
Yes.
Right. And you were given tasks right away. I mean, you were shown various things and then you were told to continue alone in your own time.
Yes, and they sold videotapes there. And you
Right.
can get all the Tensegrity videos, they now have them on YouTube. So if you type in Tensegrity, you can see the movements that I was taught initially for the first 10 years of my involvement. And what he said once Carlos was introduced into these seminars, he said there are thousands of movements. That they were just showing us a specific branch of these movements to do specific things. So, one of the intents was to become an insect. And this is all, again, to shift the assemblage point, to change your perception. Instead of being a human, try to go into the physical body of being a bee or a wasp or some other type of insect, because these are ancient beings that actually are magical beings, and you're trying to connect this thread into their phylum, basically. So you're trying to connect with this ancient knowledge.
And what was your initial impressions then of the individuals there, Florinda and Taisha and the others?
That's a great question because, again, as you kind of step away from a period of your life and examine that period of your life, you try to unpack what it is that drew you in. Like, how did you become indoctrinated, and what was the sales pitch that worked? And for me, I saw two very vital women that were clearly in their 60s, but had the bodies of 25-year-olds, seemed like they had a tremendous amount of energy. And they were very clear in their intent and everything that they were saying. So you know, I don't know if you've ever spoken in front of hundreds of people. I know that I haven't. Even the biggest crowd I've ever spoken in front of is 100 people, and it's extremely intimidating. Mm-hmm. And to see these women be able to comport themselves and answer questions from a mass of people who have a very, very specific idea about these books and mm-hmm. what these books mean to them was incredible. Like, they never seemed like they were caught off guard, or like the answers were manufactured or fabricated. This was their truth. And so when I saw them, I was like, wow, these people have their shit together. They know what the fuck they're talking about. They're not just snake oil salesmen, you know? So I think that was the thing that I was immediately drawn to. First, that it was women. Secondly, that they were not really... they didn't seem to be very focused on their looks or wearing a lot of makeup or very fancy clothes. It was all very understated, but there was a little bit, you did feel a little bit of this culty element because they all had short hair and they all had this kind of same shine and glint in their eyes. And so I just, there was something that I responded to. They had energy. That's probably the best way I can describe it.
And when you said initially that you felt that there was some kind of recruiting going on right from the start, is that with hindsight, or were you aware of that at the time?
I felt it at the time because, you know, when you go into these hierarchical situations, the first thing you're looking for is who are they speaking to? Who are they attracted to? Who are the people that they... are responding to like they know them. So then it was like, okay, well, why is it that person and not that person over there? Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that was the thing that I was trying to figure out from the beginning, because I am extremely skeptical. And I have seen people go into cult-like situations or cults, and I know how easy it is for this insidious indoctrination to happen. And so that was the part that I felt a little bit trepidatious about. It was like, do they just like people that are beautiful? Do they just like people that are wealthy? Like, I noticed that the people who seemed to have the most chi or the most relationships with them were people that were very attractive and that seemed to have a different type of, I mean, I would hate to say that they had money, but that's what it felt like. It was like, I you can tell by someone's demeanor and their dress, mm-hmm. you know, kind of how they live their life. And if they're wearing, you know, you can be wearing a tracksuit, but it's a $5,000 tracksuit, you know. And so I just noticed that it seemed to be that those were the people that they knew. Now, what I didn't know is that he'd been giving these talks. So a lot of the people that were being responded to were people who had been seeing Pastaneda for years at Phoenix Bookstore, and they knew that these seminars were happening. So they were kind of already quote unquote in without necessarily being teachers or in his close knit group.
And those bookshop seminars, they were under the radar. They weren't advertised, or did you find out later how that proceeded?
I think that they were advertised locally, like in Santa Monica. I don't know of him going public. You know, he wasn't someone that you would ever see on television. He wasn't someone that you would read in People magazine. So there wasn't this sense, like if you went to like the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles, which was at the time the very famous kind of esoteric bookstore, if you went there, you would know what was going on. Like there is kind of an elite group of people that play with this world and live in and out of this world. And some of those people are in Hollywood. Some of those people are writers. So I think if you were part of that community, you knew what was going on, but it was never advertised in any other place other than where they were doing a seminar. I don't think it was ever like in a magazine or, you know, this is pre-internet where
pre-internet,
it wasn't something that you would go and find a website for them.
Right. So on that first seminar, were you yourself hoping to get special attention and Did you notice if you did receive any special attention from them?
I did, and I received it from the teacher, from Kylie. She was immediately drawn to me, and it was almost like this energetic love affair that I felt with all of them because I finally felt like, okay, I'm around people that I resonate with. I'm someone that I have a lot of physical energy, and that translates into my size and just my demeanor and the way that I comport myself. So I'm very open and I can talk to anyone. And when they would walk around the room to kind of instruct the group or to view the group, they seemed to be attracted to me. She seemed to be attracted to me. She was a very powerful woman. She had this very, almost like Easter Island face, with this very, pronounced brow. And I just felt like this love for her, this deep, and abiding affection for her, because she seemed like someone who had sacrificed a lot to be there. She had completely devoted herself to Carlos and to these teachings and was really in earnest trying to make sure that people were doing the movements properly. And so I just put it was like the whole world disappeared. And when it came time to do the movements, I was absolutely focused on that. At that point, we were still allowed to take notes. So I did take notes kind of hither and thither during that first weekend. But I tried to be more present because they said, if you're taking notes, you're really losing the moment. You're not here with us. You're writing everything down.
It's
But
ironic for
yeah.
Castaneda followers.
Yeah, exactly. So he said, so they banned notes eventually, where you were not allowed to write down what was happening because they said this is bringing you out of the moment. You have to be completely present in order to be listening to these talks, in order to be here. And that's to me, that's a form of hypnotism as well. Because if you're writing, your attention is bifurcated and it's a lot harder for someone to hypnotize you than if you're just staring blankly at someone standing on stage and speaking.
So this person, Kylie, is her name?
Kylie Lundahl was her name.
Kylie Lundahl. Did she have any other names? Because they usually
Oh,
have
I'm sure.
a
I'm sure.
bunch.
I'm sure she did. They all
Okay.
do.
Just because it's not familiar to me, so because she's not mentioned. I don't. Is she mentioned in? You said you hadn't read Sorcerer's Apprentice, but as far as you know,
She's
is she
mentioned,
mentioned?
yes, she's mentioned everywhere. She's
Is she?
mentioned in Sorcerer's Apprentice. She's the woman that's she's one of the women that I believe is in the Magical Passes book, and she's the teacher in all three of the Tensegrity videos. She's the primary teacher.
Okay.
And she's one of the women who has disappeared.
Okay, she's one of the disappearing women. And not to get sidetracked, but just briefly, what's her story? Like, how, do you know how she met Castaneda?
I know the official story, and then I know the story that Ellis told me when Amy Wallace slash Ellis Finnegan, that she the story she told me. The story that Kylie told and that Florinda told at a seminar was that they had met in Europe, that Florinda had gone to this art gallery because Kylie was an artist. And by some weird happenstance, Florinda ate a lot of chocolate and got incredibly sick. And Kylie was the person who helped her to get better. And she knew who she was. She knew that she was involved with Carlos Castaneda. And she said, I want to come to Los Angeles. I want to be there with him. If he's there, I want to go there. And Florinda said, and she said this at a seminar, that she told her, if you want to come, then you'll do whatever it takes. Sell your body if you have to. So that was the mandate. Now, from what I was told by Ellis, is that she did sell her body. I don't know the context of that, if she was a exotic dancer or if she was a sex worker. I have no idea. But I know that she basically turned her back on her entire life and made this leap to come to California and then never looked back. And her family for over 20 years has been trying to find her.
Okay, so that was the official story, or that was Amy Wallace's version?
That was the combined official story and Amy Wallace's story. Amy Wallace said that she prostituted herself to get the money.
I think that might have been in the book. I mean, that rings a bell.
And Florinda said, you'll do whatever it takes to get here. If you want to be there, you'll do whatever it takes.
Right.
Because she wanted to leave right then. She was like, I want to get on a plane with you. Like, let's go. And they're like, no, you got to do this on your own.
Right. Okay, so when was your next experience after the first seminar?
Well, I mean, once I found out there were seminars, I just started to go on that cycle. And it was just like any seminar that I could get to, I was going to. There was a women's seminar that I went to over a weekend. There was the week-long intensive seminar that I went to. And then I found out that they were starting to have, and we went to New York. I went to Mexico City. So what I found out was that they were also having these secret Sunday classes. So they would have the primary seminar, and then every Sunday, Carlos had a group of people that varied from 10 to 30 people in this group that would meet every Sunday in Santa Monica at a place called Dance Home. And Ellis was one of the people who was the organizer who would call people and tell them to come to this secret Sunday class. But it very quickly became a not secret, because people who weren't invited to the class, who knew what was going on, spread the word to other people that were, you know, peripheral people that were going to seminars and saying, hey, you know, you should try to get invited, or somehow you've got to get into this thing. Like, this is another meeting with him where you can actually do movements and actually have a private audience with him. And so I am kind of the Groucho Marx person. I don't want to be involved in a club that would have me as a member. So mm-hmm. I didn't try to get in to this thing. I wanted to be invited. Like, I was still a little bit haughty in my ego. Like, they came to me and said, you're not a bored fuck. You have a lot of energy. You can do this. If you want to do this stuff, and you can make this leap. You have enough chi to do that. And so I took that as, now I'm not best friends with these people and I get to hang out with them all the time. I took it as like, here's your homework. Now go do it and mm-hmm. let's see what happens. And so that was really more my energy, is that I wanted to have my own experiences. I didn't want to try to link myself to other people and have other people tell me what the experience was. I wanted to see if I could do it. I wanted to see if I could dream. I wanted to see if I could accrue inner silence, if I could stop the world. And the more I did the work, the stronger those instincts became, and the easier it became to get me closer to being able to do those things. So that was really the hook. Getting together with him, of course, like anyone in their right mind would have wanted to have any kind of an audience with him. But again, I wanted to be invited. I didn't want it to be that I was like a puppy, like begging to get in. I wanted them to want me.
So did you end up going to the Sunday meets or not?
I went to one that was for Spanish speakers, because he had the quote unquote secret Sunday class. And then he had a class for people that spoke Spanish. And I was invited to one of those. And I was given an audience with him at that one meeting, because the person that I was with, we were going to get married. He was my cohort, my partner in this world. And we met at the UCLA seminar. So he wanted me to meet Carlos and get Carlos's opinion of me and whether or not he should marry me. And Carlos took one look at me and he said, she's not a bored fuck. You can't ever have sex with her. If you do, she'll kill you. Mm-hmm. Because this guy had very little energy. And he felt like he was, you know, in this grease tunnel, and he was trying to crawl his way to the top to get freedom because he was so a bored fuck. He had no chi. He used to tell me when my parents conceived me, my dad rolled over and stuck his dick in my mother, and that was it. So there was no passion. So he had no, he felt like he had no energy. And Carlos reinforced that. What I think it did for him was that it made him drive even harder and work even harder to get through, to try to break in to not only the group, but break through his own ego and his own, the things that were blocking him and snagging him.
What was your first encounter with Castaneda? When was the first time you saw him speaking?
First time I saw him face to face, I want to say, was at the UCLA seminar, the week-long seminar. He was, I would say, somewhere between 5'3 and 5'4, very slight man. He had totally gray, almost whitish gray hair. He had a very round face and a very big smile. He seemed like his vision wasn't necessarily great, but he was extremely thin. He always wore beautiful suits. And this is someone who was so verbose. You could get him started talking and he would go on for hours because he was so passionate about his work and sharing his work. So that was my first introduction, was during that seminar. He gave several talks. And that, I mean, for me, that was the whole reason I was there, was to see him.
Hmm. So he met your expectations then?
I think he was a fascinating storyteller. He used to say, I look like a Mexican valet. Like, I don't look like someone who would be a guru or, you know, be the godfather or the grandfather of the New Age movement. He felt like he didn't look the part, because at one point he'd gone on this journey to try to find a real guru. And in those travels, he met all types of people, and, you know, they all had pretty much the same energy or air. They were either very tall or, you know, wearing robes and had a certain mystique about them. And he didn't have that at all. He really looked, I mean, I wouldn't say he looked like a valet, but he just looked like, you know, a regular Hispanic man to me. There was nothing remarkable about him physically.
Sure, but that wouldn't, I mean, I don't know exactly, of course, what your expectations would have been, but if I put myself in your shoes, I wouldn't have expected him to look physically different in any way. I certainly wouldn't have expected him to appear guru-like, but I would have expected something you had said about your impressions of the women, like an unusual degree of vitality, and then I would have expected, I guess, something like a mysterious, you know, quality of wisdom and power to be emanating from him. Something along those lines, I guess, was more what I was referring to.
Yeah, I mean, he said, I can see energy. And, you know, the way he described it was like, it was almost like a movie screen. And he could see, I don't know if it was words or images, but when he was talking about that, it felt like something that you would think, oh, this person's glowing, or they have some higher, they're vibrating in a higher frequency. And I never really felt like that. I felt his passion and his intensity, and I felt like he really believed everything that he was saying, but he didn't float into the room. You know, he didn't come in as this orb of light, you know. And I think that when you're talking about these mystical things and these magical things, you kind of want to see some evidence of that. You want to see people that are vibrating at a higher frequency. You want to feel that. I saw him again at an Oakland seminar, and he came up to me and physically touched me. And again, I didn't feel any electricity from him. I felt a connection with him, but it wasn't like I've been touched by Jesus Christ. Like, I didn't feel like I'd been touched by this higher being. He just seemed like a man who was very convinced of what he was saying.
This is possibly a kind of impossible question, but maybe you've thought about it. If you had met Castaneda and started going to seminars without having read any of the books, how different would your experience have been, do you think, and how likely is it that you would have got pulled in?
That's a great question, Jason. No one's ever asked me that. I think that had I not read the books, it would have been impossible to indoctrinate me, because I didn't have, if you just take the movements as what they are, it would be very easy to say, oh, this is Tai Chi, or I'm doing something that's very yoga-esque. But because there was a background there and there was a backstory there that he claimed was the catalyst and the impetus for all of these experiences, that was the thing that really hooked me. What I found strange was that he never mentioned tensegrity in any book. He never mentioned recapitulation in any book. None of these things were brought to the fore until allegedly the Blue Scout came back. He brought the Blue Scout back from the Second Intention.
Recapitulation is in the books. I'm not sure what point, but it's definitely in the, yeah, I think it was fifth or sixth or something.
Yeah. So it's in a later work. It's not like in his initial first or second book.
No. And do you think that most of the people who were there, if not all of the people, had read the books?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And how much was he referring to the books or to Don Juan, or how much did it feel like it was a continuation of the teachings in the books, and how much did it feel like it was his own thing?
He referred to Don Juan constantly. He referred to the old seers constantly. He referred to Don Juan's party constantly. He now just added this layer that had been a secret layer for all time. So that was the thing. Again, that was the thing that was a little bit bizarre to me. It was like, well, why didn't you really discuss these magical passes in the first book? Why didn't you ever talk about Don Juan doing these magical passes? I always found it interesting that he knew none of the Yaqui language, that none of his experience really is consistent with the Yaqui people at all. So to me, I was like, well, what part of this is Toltec or Yaqui knowledge, and what part of this is Don Juan, this person that you allege that you had these experiences with? So that was the thing that felt inconsistent to me. Had he been talking about Tensegrity all along and then suddenly said, okay, now I'm going to teach it. We've been talking about this for 40 years. Now it's time for me to give this to the world. I could never figure out why all of a sudden there were these seminars. I could never figure out why all of a sudden there were, like, he was marketing it, why there were books, and, you know, he was giving interviews in magazines. He did an interview in Details magazine. It just seems so off brand for him to suddenly be selling freedom.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever find a satisfactory answer to that?
They wanted money. They wanted money.
Couldn't he just have written more books, though?
Well, I think he'd kind of played that out. I think he'd played the subject out. It's like, once Don Juan made that leap, what's the next, you know, how do you manufacture him returning if you don't know where he is? So I think that was a stretch. So it was easier to bring in this new system of movement that Florinda had practiced karate, Taisha had practiced karate. I think that their influence was very, very resonant with him, that it was very important for him to include them. And this was a way to kind of sell this package, this mystical package. So he's got these witches. He has the story that Carol Tiggs was gone for 10 years. He has the story that he brought this little girl back from the second attention. Now she's his daughter. Now she's his wife. So he has all of these things that he's kind of taken, and now he's adding this other element of, oh, and if you're interested in doing this work, here's the system that you need to actually make that happen and do it. And so it seemed very manufactured. Like, it didn't seem like it was coming from a place of like a true altruistic desire. And someone even asked at a seminar, well, why do you charge so much money for these things? Why do you charge for seminars? Why do you charge for these videotapes? If you're trying to share this with the world, why isn't it free? And his answer was, I asked the Blue Scout when I told her that I was wanting to do this. And she said, people, you've been giving talks at the Phoenix Bookstore for 10 years and not one person has paid you a dime to do that. People don't come, they don't give a shit if it's free. If you put a dollar amount on it, then the people who go there are going to be interested because they've paid their ticket and they want to make sure they get something out of it.
Mm-hmm. So, but you were doing the Tensegrity movements from the first seminar on.
Absolutely. Yeah?
So they were central to many or all of the events that you went to.
That was the whole reason for the events and the lectures.
So when did you start to feel the way that you're feeling, expressing now, that they somehow didn't feel genuine?
I think, again, this is where, you know, it's very hard to kind of unpack this stuff, because I feel like anything that you do with pure intent, if you decide to take on yoga with pure intent, that can be a spiritual experience. If you decide to meditate, that can be a spiritual experience. Anything that you put your energy into and really divorce your ego from that experience, I think that you have the ability to have new information and to gather new information. So in the whole time that I was with the group or going to these seminars, I was very much active in the movements and doing the work. When probably 2013, after I worked with Alice on her book in 2000, in 2013 is when I really started, after those that 13-year period, where I really started to examine what had happened. And I did a lot of research and I was like, was this a cult? Was I indoctrinated into something? Did I give away my sovereignty to something? Not what did I get back from them, but what did I give up? Like how much of myself did I really devote to this? And in doing research, I started to figure out that there were these pockets that the government was working with all over the United States that, you know, unbeknownst to a lot of researchers, they were doing private funded studies by the CIA. And so it came to me, I said, you know, maybe it's very possible, because he was in UCLA, he was in the anthropology department, it was still in the height of the MK Ultra program, these things were still going on. It's very possible that he could have been a unsuspecting beneficiary of one of these studies or one of these funds. And, you know, I it would be a stretch to say that he had been hypnotized and he had created this character, but I don't know. I really don't know what his, what the seed of where he decided to come out with Don Juan was. I don't know what it was inside of him that decided, okay, now's the time to write this book. Now's the time to expose myself and really be under the microscope, because when you create this character, you have to have something to back that up. You can't just say, oh, I have this mystical experience, but I have no field notes and I have no way of bringing him into the public to share him with the world. It's just my word against the world. So I think that was the thing that I started to go, well, there's really no evidence other than what he said, and suddenly what he's brought these four other women into the group, and now they're publicly saying to corroborate or confirm that Don Juan ever existed.
Mm-hmm. So in the group, I mean, how much did you feel that you were part of a group? Because it seems as though they were moving around in terms of seminars. Obviously, Castaneda had his own place in Los Angeles, and I think some of the witches lived with him. But there was never a compound. So in terms of a cult, it's obviously a much less clearly defined thing. But so how much did you end up actually in a circle, so to speak?
Well, he actually did live on a compound on Pandora. And Joni Barker, who was one of the first women that he had involved with him, she lived there. She was never at a seminar. She lived in an apartment and lived there for 30 plus years. Nai, Rennie, Kylie, the witches, they all lived on this property. And so they had their world that they were living in. My best friend was hired by Clear Green to work answering the phones as a receptionist. So I was privy to a lot of what was going on. She then went on to be a teacher for Tensegrity. Her husband was one of the teachers in Tensegrity. So I was very close to people that were in the group, going to Sunday classes, going to private events with him. She had a lot of involvement. So by osmosis and just by association, I knew what was going on. The person that I was married to, he was also involved in the Sunday classes. He was also involved in he was from Argentina. So he was also going to the Spanish talks as well. So I would say, like, in the layers of the onion, I was probably three layers out from the center. Again, I only went to one Sunday class there was the Spanish speaking class. I was never invited to any of the Sunday meetings. Again, that was something that I took as part of my own ego thing. Like, okay, they don't want me, whatever the relationship is, I'm still going to do the work. And maybe this is part of it, is they've taken my best friend, they've separated us, they've taken her, and now she's in and I'm not in, or not as in. Now, she, for years, she said, you were always in the group, you were like somehow I need that. But to me, again, I didn't want to be somewhere that I wasn't asked to be there. I knew people who stormed his house, who filmed him surreptitiously, who did everything they could to weasel their way in there. Marilyn Tunishinde claimed that she was a student of Don Juan's. Carlos very clearly said, this woman has no part of our group. She has nothing to do with us. She never knew Don Juan. She's living in her own fantasy. So because I was still a young woman and very like egocentric, I didn't want to be like trying to shove my way in there. I wanted them to invite me. So anytime I was invited to a movie or anything that had to do with the group, I was more than happy to go, but I wasn't going to try to secretly find out where the Sunday class was and then force myself in there. I just felt like if they want me there, they'll ask me. If they don't, they won't. But I noticed that the women that surrounded him were very protective of him. And so they blocked a lot of people that tried to have interaction and contact with him. So his ex, Marguerite Runyon, and her son, CJ, they tried to go to seminars. They tried to go to the house. He had a restraining order on them. He made sure that they were blocked and not allowed to come to any of these seminars. And again, you have to look at that and say, well, why would he do that? Why would he not want his ex-wife there, the person who was with him when he allegedly met Don Juan, who could corroborate his story? Why would he make sure to legally block him, her, and the son from his life? So that's my long answer to your short question.
And so you were quite close to Amy Wallace then?
Yes. Yes.
Was she the one that you were closest to then of all the witches?
Well, Amy Wallace wasn't a witch. She was his lover. She was someone who was involved with him throughout her whole life. She met him when she was 17 years old. Her father, Irving Wallace, was a quite famous writer. And again, Carlos liked to swim in these circles of famous people. And so he loved to be invited to parties with famous people. And he and Amy met in, I believe, Berkeley, California. And she talks about that in her book and how they first met and the relationship and the connection. When we were in, from the beginning, after that first seminar, a lot of these things were cost prohibitive. So I had to figure out a way to get the money to go to fly to New York, to pay for accommodation, to be able to pay for the seminars. So they did what they called a work study program. So I started to work for the seminars, and I would do setup and breakdown and help with the sound, moving equipment in and out. And so I got to be close with Amy, because she was one of the people who was very much a part of the organization of these seminars. I got to be close with the people who ran the sound. And these were all people who were in the Sunday class and connected with him. So my way of being a part of it was service. It was like, I want to be a part, but I don't necessarily have tens of thousands of dollars to take a year off to be jumping, you know, globe hopping around the world to go to these seminars. So I did whatever I could to bring those costs down to be able to afford to go. And when you're in these kinds of environments, you kind of see behind the velvet curtain. You get to see the real people. You get to see the notes that they're writing for the talk. So when Carol Tiggs gave a talk at one specific seminar, she left her notes behind, and they had stage directions of how she was going to walk off the stage and where she was going to make these emphases in her dialogue. And it was very manufactured, which I found very interesting. It wasn't like a stream of consciousness discussion. It was like every word had been mapped out. And so at the end of this particular seminar, I found these notes, and one of the inner circle came just stampeding into the room trying to find her notes. And I said, "Oh, here you are," and handed them right over. And it was so amazing. It was like these things ingratiated me because I became like a trusted person. They knew that I wasn't trying to bust them or to take anything that wasn't mine. I was very much like, I wanted to be, have this clear intent and this clear energy with them. And so it was important for me to do everything that I could when I was there to be impeccable and have integrity and not try to catch them out. And I felt like there were other people there who were very skeptical, who would bring up his book and say, "Okay, on page 248, you said this, and now you're saying something opposite. Like, what am I supposed to think?" And at one seminar, he said, "Throw my books away. That's old knowledge. That's old stuff. That was what was specific for me at that time. This is a new time. It's a new era. And so what I'm saying now is what I'm reading off of the wall. This is the energy." So that gives you a lot of wiggle room.
Mm-hmm.
You're suddenly questioned about something very specific that you said, and then you whitewash it and say, "Oh, that doesn't really matter. Now focus on this." Then, you know, there's a suspension of disbelief there. Like, are you going to believe this person? And I think for the most part, people who were paying their money, because they paid their money and they were trying to get something out of it, they wanted to believe. I don't know that they were doing the work. I don't know if they were having their own experiences, but they wanted to believe what was being said. And so it was easy for them to go, "Okay, yeah, you're right. I'm not going to read the books anymore." But they were still selling the books, which is kind of ironic.
Like, buy them and then throw them away, and then buy them again.
Exactly. Listen, and it's so hard and safe.
So coming back to Amy Wallace then, at what point did she start writing the book that became Sorcerer's Apprentice? Do you remember?
Yeah, she started writing it in 2000
So after he'd died.
after he died.
Okay.
And she, she'd had a very intense childhood. At one point, I'm a writer and I love writers. And I had this idea that I would love to write a book about famous writers and their process. Like, how do they write their books? And because everyone's different. And so one day we were, she, because my best friend was working for Clear Green, she was very close with Amy. And Amy said, "I need help editing this book." And so my best friend said, "Well, Hunter and I can do it. We'll double to, we'll tag team it. We can do it together. Like, she'll do one draft, I'll do the next, and we make sure that it's we've dotted our all of our I's and crossed our T's." So Amy agreed. She hired us. And then, it turned into all these other tasks that she needed us to do. But at the time, I asked her, I said, "Well, what was your father's process? Like, how did he write?" And she said that he was an amphetamine addict. So he would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning. He would start his ritual of amphetamines that were prescribed by his doctor and write until 5 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, he would turn to alcohol and depressants. And then at night, they would have dinner parties and they would, have cocktail hour and socialize. So she grew up with two parents who had active drug addictions. So taking pharmaceuticals was a very normal thing in her reality. That was something that you saw your mom and dad do. And so she adopted that behavior, I would imagine, at probably a fairly young age. And then that just went throughout her adult life. I think the anxiety of the way that Carlos left and the witches left and the abruptness of it threw her into her disease, probably far deeper than she imagined that she could ever get out of. So when we started editing the book, it was very incoherent. It was extremely inconsistent. She would she was having drugs delivered to her from this company that delivers methadone. If you're, a hyper wealthy person, you never have to go to a methadone clinic. You never have to go to a pharmacy to get your drugs. You get it all home delivered. So she was getting these massive amounts of drugs delivered to her home. And the predominant meetings that we ever had would be she would be in the bathroom shooting up or taking pills, and we would be in her bedroom with just tons and tons of these chapters just strewn all over her bed, and then kind of slipping something underneath the door. And as she sat on the toilet, she would rewrite something in her scrawl and then hand it back to us. And then I would go and I had one of her laptops there and I would retype what she had written. But in the, in a 12-hour period of working for her, I would go home and I'd have my pages and my best friend would have her pages and we would edit those pages. The next day we'd go to work and she'd go, "Oh, throw those away. I rewrote that last night."
Right.
So it was this hamster wheel of trying to rein in this person who was on a cocktail of pharmaceuticals that took her to all different places where she would be up all night writing and crying and, upset. And I think it was her coping skill that she needed to write the book, but she couldn't keep her shit together to write it to make it an easy process. So that was the challenge that I had, was that I really wanted the work out there and I really wanted her. I was a champion of her and I really wanted her to tell her story. But I felt like there were points where I wanted it more than she did because she was so in a fog that she couldn't get it together and she couldn't keep it together. And so she, and Carlos talked about this when he was still alive. At one point on during a Sunday class, he said, "You guys are telling Ellis all of your secrets." like, why are you doing this? Why are you dumping all this stuff on her? And then it makes her really sick and she gets really freaked out because you've told her all these private things. So I feel like she felt like she was a little bit of a dumping ground because she was the bridge between Carlos and, you know, these 30, 40, 50 people who were trying to get into this Sunday class. And so he said at one point, he goes, "Why? She's a writer. She's going to write about you. She's going to tell your secrets if you keep telling her this stuff." And she, in fact, did. Like, a lot of the stuff that she put in her book was stuff that she culled from other people, that she was trying to corroborate her experience with other people's experience. And I think that it was very clear that when you're telling someone else's story, you don't always necessarily get the nuance. You don't always necessarily get it right. And that was the part that got really difficult for me, because I felt like there was almost like this vampiric thing that she was in this hole and she was kind of trying to drag us down there with her because she was so depressed and so upset after he'd gone, because they very unceremoniously left. After he died, they hid the fact that he died. Then all of a sudden, all of the women's phones were disconnected. They were seen leaving the house and never came back. Now, that was cutting off from Ellis. That was cutting off from all of the other teachers, from the men, Bruce Wagner, all the men that were in the group. It was like, here today, gone tomorrow. And so I think that was an extremely hard thing for her, is that she had basically been abandoned and with no word of where they went or if they were alive or dead. And I think that that left a big hole for her. She was not close with Carol Tiggs. They had a very divisive relationship. So it wasn't like she was going and having deep and meaningfuls with Carol. Carol held up in her house and wasn't publicly seen for a while after he was gone. So there were these big question marks of what happened. Like, you guys claimed that he was gonna die the death of a warrior. You claimed that he was gonna burn from within. At one seminar, Kylie claimed that she came in the room, and this was toward the end before he died, and she said he had shrunken down to 4 feet, like he was leaving. But it was like his body had gone from this normal size body and had now suddenly become smaller and smaller, like he was literally disintegrating. And so, you know, when you hear these things, it's like, well, what the fuck happened to him? Did he die a normal death? Did he burn from within? Did he? And so there was a coroner's report. His body was taken to LA County, as they always are. Like, he went through the process of a man who died an ordinary death. And so there was, it was like, that doesn't make sense. This was the Nawal. This was the holder of the truth. Like, how is this person, if this person couldn't make it, then how the fuck do any of us have a chance to make it? Because he died of cancer. You know, he didn't burn from within. He didn't do what they claimed. And instead of coming out and saying, we don't know why this happened, but this is what happened and it happened this way, they still tried to make it, you know, throw this veneer over it, like, you know, he died a magical death. But because I knew Amy and I knew her well, I knew what really happened. And so that was the thing that was so disenchanting for me, because it was like, this can't, like, how could he have not done what he claimed he was doing?
So for you, it was a combination of his death, the circumstances of his death, with what you began to find out about the goings-on of the inner circle via Amy.
And just horrible, horrible things. You know, they played this game. I mean, Jason, it's so sick. Like, now that I think about it, I can't believe that people I love were involved with this. But it was like changing sex partners. Like, if you had sex with Carlos, then these women use that power against men So they would say, like Amy said, like, I've had sex with Carlos. So if you want to achieve freedom, if you want to make it, you've got to have sex with me. And so she tried to lure men in that were in the group that didn't necessarily want to be intimate with her, like created these environments of like foursomes and, you know, group sex situations. And I know people who physically left because they were like, this is not the road to freedom. And if you're trying to sell me this thing that you have a magic pussy and that I need to fuck you in order to get to freedom, I ain't buying that. And so that's when, again, I started to be like, this is weird. Like, he's done these weird things, or he's stolen their jewelry, and, you know, he's called these people all types of horrible names, and he's had all these enmeshed weird relationships with these people, and now these women are trying to use their sexual power against men for some odd gain I don't know or understand. It was like all of it started to unravel, and I think the way, because it was left so hastily, I think so many people reacted in different ways. There were people who went and tried to kill themselves because they were like, he's gone, I gotta go try to grab the back of that comet, like the tail end of that, and maybe there's still a chance to get to him. So this is one of the theories that Amy put in her book that I have a really hard time with, and it's the trigger effect. Because in The Eagle's Trust, which is his will, they talk about a triggering event, which means that how the money was distributed changes if this triggering event happens. So if these top witches disappear, then the next level of this hierarchy gets the money and gets the movie rights and gets control of basically his whole legacy. And so she opined that what the triggering event was, the trigger effect, that the witches all went to a cave in Death Valley and stood in a circle and shot each other and killed each other to, again, make that leap and reach him. I don't think that that happened, Jason. I'm not saying that these women were egomaniacs. I'm not saying that they had no love for him. But I have a really, really hard time believing that these multimillionaire women went to a cave and shot themselves and left the money, their wealth, to the Clear Green organization. I just don't buy that.
So where has the legacy gone to then officially?
Okay, well, you can see on sustainedaction.org, you can see how everything was distributed. What's really weird is in the very end, he gave all of his film rights to a woman who had just begun to go to the seminars, kind of at the tail end, this very tall blonde woman, that he signed over all the film rights to her. So now she has the right to make films about his books.
What's her name?
Haley Van Oosten was the name, the alleged name that she was given. Her legal name is Nina.
Okay, and what about the rest of the heritage?
Well, from what I was told, the women, the witches, left, and they left the country. Now, you're talking about people who would be very easy for them to get identification, false identification. I know people that were in the group and very close and enmeshed in the group that knew where to get false documents in Los Angeles. This was something that was very well known because there were people that were not legal to be in the country. They were in the country as tourists and yet working or wanting to work. And so they got fake documents so that they could work legally in the United States. So these people knew how to access that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. I believe that when he left, they hid the money that they wanted and needed to hide, and they jumped ship and they left the country. I don't think that they're dead. I think Florinda, Taisha, and Kylie, and also Talia, the woman who was the president of Clear Green, I think they're all still very much alive and that they're living overseas. I think there's been enough time between when these seminars were happening and they were out in the public and now that they could have easily changed their appearance. And they were known for stalking and taking on other personalities and other appearances, even being men. So it's not it's in the realm of possibility is what I'm trying to say, that they could have just jumped ship. Sure. But again, all the monies, all of that stuff was distributed amongst the people that were either teachers or close within that close-knit group.
Oh, so there wasn't a large single sum that went anywhere. It was just distributed among a large number of people.
I think he had assets in the $1.4, $1.5 million range. That doesn't include the home. They have sold that home. And as far as the Clear Green thing goes, what Ellis told me is that on his deathbed, someone said, well, what do we do with Clear Green? Your organization, the seminars, like, what do we do? And he said, I don't care. Throw it away. Do whatever you want with it.
Mm-hmm.
So those people that Rennie, Bruce Wagner, Carol Tiggs, these people are still giving seminars.
Okay. All right. So they're the visible inheritors of the Castaneda estate.
Yes.
Right. Right. Okay, well, I definitely want to get to Bruce Wagner, as you know, but I just want to tie up, if possible, with Amy Wallace and the book, because I think it came out around 2004, something like that. So who, and you said you haven't read it since it came out, so who do you know who actually got it into that finished form? Because it's very smooth and coherent now as a book. I've read it two or three times, and it's well written, and it all makes sense, and it's very, very compelling and persuasive in terms of exposing the inner workings of Castaneda cult. Well, how accurate it is, obviously I can't sure. vouch for, but it's definitely very well edited. So do you know who finally got it into shape?
I'm sure it was her editor or her publisher. I'm sure, because she was 3 years, it was actually released in 2003, and she was 3 years behind the deadline. Right. It was supposed to be finished in 2000 when we started working on it. She had a 3-month window to write the book. Of course, that deadline got blown out of the water. And I left and went to Australia in December of 2000 and then was traveling back and forth for the next 4 years from Australia to the United States. So I lost touch with the book. I lost touch with Amy. And I know people who were still very much involved with her. And I think that she went into, she worked more directly with her editor and didn't have people with her working directly. So I think that's probably who really tightened up the book in the end.
Hmm. I wonder, maybe did she clean up with the drugs, do you think?
Oh, no.
No.
No. I mean, the drugs are what killed her. Yeah. I sent you a link of an op-ed that her brother wrote in the Huffington Post, because, you know, he'd lost his sister to a drug addiction, and it was a legal pharmaceutical drug addiction. And I think it was so devastating to him that he had to expose that. I did want to tell you something about my time with her that was actually really hilarious. She, you know, when she was with Castaneda, as I told you before, he demanded that she give away her cats. He demanded that she give away her possessions, her jewelry, everything that she owned that she was attached to, because he said that she was so attached to these things that these were the things that were holding her back and preventing her from being in this journey and being on this road. And she did these things, but never without resentment. So at one point, when my best friend and I were working with her, she, you know, as I said, you could tell the people who were doing the work and the people who weren't. And Amy really fell into the category of people who weren't doing the work. She told me, I don't like doing tensegrity. I don't like the recapitulation. I'm not into this. Like, I'm not into doing the stuff. She liked him. She was in love with him. She wanted to be with him. But all of the things that he was doing weren't things that really interested her. So when he made her give these things up, it wasn't without resentment. Like, she did it, but then she felt angry about it. So at one point, I had issues with a vehicle, and she loaned me a vehicle. She had this little Honda that she loaned us so that we could go out and run errands for her. Well, she had the car bugged. So she would listen to the conversations that we were having in the car. And then the next day when we would go to work, she would pretend like she had magically dreamed word for word what we had said. So we tested this. So one day we're in the car and I told my best friend, I said, you know, I really love Amy. She's so amazing. She's so generous. She's so kind. She's just, you know, she's so impeccable, and she's done so much to really help us get through this grieving process of losing our teacher. The next day I go to work, she throws her arms around me, kissing me all over the face, telling me how much she loved me because she'd listened to me saying all of these loving things about her. So one of the tasks that she had us do, you know, other than editing her book or running and fetching and getting sandwiches or going to Whole Foods for her, she said, I want you to go and steal all of my jewelry back.
From who?
From Carol Tiggs.
Yeah.
Now, Carol lived in the same neighborhood, similar neighborhood to Amy. And so Amy gave us this car. She paid us like, I think it was like $25, $30 an hour to go and stalk this woman. Now, my best friend and I were never going to break and enter into anyone's home. We were never, ever, ever going to steal anything from anybody. But we wanted to basically placate Ellis because she felt so entitled and so angry that her things had been taken and given to this other woman that she wanted her shit back. So we would go and sit in front of this woman's house for hours and just watch to see if anyone came and went. We saw Bruce coming in and out of the house. We would just sit there and, you know, sometimes get stoned or just sit in the car and laugh or, you know, whatever. But I just remember thinking, this is fucking absurd that this woman is so trapped and so engaged in these things that she's willing to pay someone to break into someone's head, to commit a crime and to break into this person's house and steal these belongings. You know, and I just remember thinking and saying to my best friend, I'm like, how the hell are we gonna, would we ever know where to look? Like, this is such an insane task that she's given us, but you know, it was a job. And so I just treated it like a job. And then we would go back and report and she would say, you know, did you see Carol? No, she didn't leave her house today. Well, how long did you stay there? Well, we were there for 4 hours. Okay, you know, and she would be very flustered. But I just thought, if you want your stuff back and you know this woman has it and you're a powerful being, go and knock on her door and go ask for your stuff back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't make it into this, like, TV show drama thing where you've hired people to commit a crime for you. It was just so soap opera and so bizarre, but I went along with it because I was like, well, you know, this is probably part of the training, is that, you know, I have to stalk this position, I have to put myself in this role and help this woman because she clearly needs help. But the reality was that we never had the intention of ever trying to go into anyone's home. I just thought it was hilarious that she would even suggest that.
I stole a lie.
I stole a lie.
With the brave. crashing down.
That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Hunter. The second part of the conversation will be up simultaneously at horticulture.com/liminalist.
And it rained on my house. And it rained on my house. And it rained on my house.